Hello and welcome to Criterion.
Close up.
I'm Mark Kearney and I'm here with Aaron West. Hello, Aaron.
Hello, happy... We probably shouldn't say Valentine's Day, should we?
Well, you know, we're recording on Valentine's Day, so I hope you did something special for your Valentine.
Yes, I recorded a podcast. It's all for her.
We're so nice.
We're so sweet. Yeah. Speaking of sweet, we have a very sweet couple with us, an adorable couple.
Yes. From the Magic Lantern Podcast, we have Erica and Cole. Welcome, both of you.
Thank you. Hello, everybody.
We're delighted to be here.
We're thrilled to have you.
Yeah. You've been such great supporters of the show and really great interacting with you, so we really appreciate finally having you on. This is awesome.
Yeah, we've been waiting to do it since the very beginning. We launched our shows 2 days apart from each other, I realized, when I went back to look at our early episodes, and we've always thought of you guys as sort of our class, our graduating class, it feels like. We came up through this together.
We're in it together. Yeah. I love how you do the little table reads before the episode. That's for those who haven't listened, and I recommend you do listen.
Absolutely.
They do little chit-chats from the movies. I think my favorite was the W.C. Fields one. I just love that movie.
We figure it's probably easier than trying to legitimately get rights to everything to play clips, so we just reenact them ourselves.
Yeah, Slacker, not so easy to reenact. I'm a medical doctor. Anyway.
That's the one I was going to go to, too.
Can't do that with four people, though.
No. Do you have a yacht, too? And a mansion?
Oh, the doctor thing. Sorry. I didn't follow through. No, I don't.
Unfortunate. So, well, I think you mentioned it already, Aaron. We are talking about Slacker, the Richard Linklater film from 1991, really released in 91. And we're also going to talk a bit about the Austin scene music in movies. So we have some perfect guests again for that because Erica and Cole live close to Austin. So glad to have them on for that. But before we get into reviews, of course, we have a couple of updates. But we also wanted to talk about Cole and Erica's Criterion Connection, as we always do. So first-time guests, and we want to get into that. So tell us about your connections.
We had a discussion about this before getting started because I am not a long-time collector. And so it was difficult.
No.
I am by way of marriage now.
It's okay. I'm kidding.
And so it was difficult for me to try to narrow down where I got started. But my best guess is that when I was in school, we got to watch Grand Illusion on Laserdisc. So that was a pretty great intro. Yes.
Yeah, you had Aaron at Renoir, so nice.
Yes.
So your connection actually even predates mine, most likely.
Yeah, that's
Laserdisc,
early.
Too. That's cool.
Mm-hmm. And that's Spine One for DVDs. So.
Right.
The beginning.
My connection is through The Testament of Dr. Mabuse. I first discovered that over a holiday break in 2004-2005 and ended up watching that after buying it as a blind buy at a Barnes & Noble sale over and over and over again during that long weekend, extended week on a vacation, and just fell in love with it and have been chasing that ever since.
You know, I haven't seen those actually. I know there's at least two. I think maybe three.
Yeah, there's a third
in the series.
One.
Yeah.
Thousand Eyes.
The Thousand Eyes is the only one I haven't seen.
Yeah, it's hard to get. It's out of print and it's very rare. But
they are available on Region B. I think all of them through. Is it Masters of Cinema?
Well, the first two are Dr. Mabuse, the Gambler, and then the Testament of Dr. Mabuse. They have the Blu-rays, a DVD box set, but I don't think The Thousand Eyes is available.
So yeah, in fact, I saw Testament was I think £6.99, and I almost pounced the other day, but I don't know, hoping that Criterion one day comes to their senses and brings that back.
Yeah, a Blu-ray upgrade. And you guys talked about that film just recently.
We did that. That was
episode 13.
Right, exactly.
Cool.
Thank you for knowing our podcast better than I do.
speaking of which, you Magic Lantern podcast. You mentioned episode on Suspiria is coming up, right?
Yes, we just recorded that, and we will be releasing that on Monday the 15th.
Okay.
Awesome.
Anything else in the pipeline or around the corner that you want to talk about?
With the show, we're a little freewheeling. We just decide slightly ahead of time based upon how we feel what it is that we're going to do for the next episode. But do you have one in mind?
I'm pretty definite that my next choice is going to be Wings of Desire.
Ooh. Oh, yeah. Oh, good. Again, reminder, I have a Wim Wenders poster right behind me.
Another Criterion.
Oh, I see it now.
Very nice.
Okay.
Yeah, it's behind the door there. There you go. Of course, this is great podcasting here.
It's all visual. Well, thank you. I love hearing about the connections, and should mention I do see a bunch of Criterion, more podcasting audio, a bunch of Criterion behind you as we're talking, so it's very nice to see. So should mention, we as folks noticed, we did miss an episode last week. We did record one. We talked with Kristen Sales on Fat Girl, but unfortunately, we had some audio issues that we've been working through on the editing side. Aaron has been working fast and furious on those, so those will be coming later, probably in a few days. So this episode coming first.
More slow and moderate tempered than fast and furious, but I finally got a working cut. It's kind of funny because on the episode, in fact, if you listen when it comes out later, at around the 20-minute mark, we kind of make fun of audio issues, and then when I was editing that, I was like, oh, the irony.
Yeah.
But yeah, and you will be able to tell from Kristen's track, there was a little fan that we had to do some noise reduction. So her track is going to sound a little tinny, but she was phenomenal. And in fact, as I listen back to the episode, hopefully it won't bother. I don't think many people will notice, but we just kind of wound each other up in the second half, talking about Fat Girl. We had this long diversion about, female characters through the eyes of male directors. Just really great stuff. And I think people will really appreciate Kristen and the conversation. In fact, I'd say it's one of our best and most intense conversations that we've had thus far. So
agreed.
Way to go, Kristen.
She was great.
And I think, obviously, we're doing Slacker today, and this will probably go up today on Valentine's Day. If not, then, well, you're going to know, because... but we'll probably put Fat Girl up during the week, maybe Wednesday, Thursday. We'll see.
Cool.
Listen to it. It's good.
Yeah. And we also wanted to talk about... We have another schedule update. I'm trying to really make this a little bit easier. Aaron, do you want to talk about this?
Yeah, we're a little tired. We took a week off, but we didn't really take a week off. But we have jobs, and so we decided to cut one show from our schedule per month. So we're going to cut, and unfortunately, the first one that we're going to cut is Gilda, which we were going to do next month. And part of the reason is to re-energize us, we can get more in-depth and better topics, give us more time to prepare.
Mm-hmm.
Another reason is we have cool stuff coming around the pipeline with the Criterion Cast folks that I can't announce, but I know Mark knows about it. It's awesome. And
oh, yes.
That'll probably materialize in the next few weeks, I'd say.
Yeah, so it's, like you said, it's more content upcoming, so it's not like we're really losing content, but we're also... trying to keep our sanity, trying to keep our, our families happy, keep ourselves happy, and but have time to delve into the movies and the supplements. It's not like we're just watching a movie. We are, looking into the supplements and trying to give some comprehensive, feedback and analysis. So, I think it makes sense for sure.
But what we've kind of learned from the Canadian episode we did, which was just a riot, take off. Is that these little pop-up episodes are fun and people seem to enjoy them. We got some good comments on that. So we might do more pop-up episodes. In fact, I know a pop-up episode is not something you really plan, but we're already talking about doing one in a couple months that coincides with another event. So, and of course, those will be less prep, more just initial thoughts, conversation. Mm-hmm. You got to mix it up a little bit.
Yeah. It's going to be fun. It's another and more Criterion content too. So,
right,
be good. So more to come on that, and we'll be updating the schedule online soon here, so folks can get a sense of what that's going to look like in the future. And we do have a lot of guests, as we've always said before, lined up. So you know, we're not going to be want for content or guests. So looking forward to it.
There's always something we want to cover or somebody we want to cover it with. In fact, yeah. Cole and Erica, we actually forgot about you. Sorry.
Oh, that's okay.
We slotted you back in here. But we really wanted to do this episode, but we just have a lot of activity. So we're like, oh, yeah, we got to do this one. Yeah. So we're doing it.
Yep. Perfect guests. So lastly, really, for our intro, we'd like to talk about what we are calling short takes, which is what we've been watching recently. And we've got the four of us, so we're each going to jump into one. So, Cole, I'll turn it to you first. What did you want to give us a short take on?
My short take is for Your Vice is a Locked Room and Only I Have the Key.
Ooh.
I've been in a real giallo mood lately. And this is one by Sergio Martino that is, to me, head and shoulders above your usual black leather glove, unseen killer. I would put this up there with the finest Argento stuff, with Bird with the Crystal Plumage, with Four Flies on Grey Velvet. I really liked this one. It's basically the story of a misanthropic alcoholic writer who lives in a crumbling mansion with his wife. It's a very, very loose, to be diplomatic, very, very loose interpretation of The Black Cat.
It's part of the Arrow box set, Black Cats. Am I right or wrong on that?
I think that sounds right to me, yes.
Is that how you got it? Or?
Oh, I got this one. No, I bought this as a standalone title.
Okay.
Oh,
I see they released it. They separated the box, so they're releasing it. Oh, actually, it's going to come out on April 5th.
I have the DVD. I have not upgraded to Blu-ray on this one.
Hmm. Well, you have your opportunity in 2 months if you really want to. I think I just pre-ordered it.
Well, that's great because it looks fantastic. It is not what you would think an exploitation film would typically look like in terms of the camera work and the composition of the shots. It really is a cut above.
Perfect. I haven't even heard of that film, so long title.
Giallo titles are the greatest.
It's got roughly 5,000 times more nudity than The Black Cat, so.
5,000 times. Mm-hmm. Wow, yeah. That's some good math there, mm-hmm. Erica. Did you sit there with a calculator?
I did.
Well, I think you just sold Mark.
No, I usually shoot for 10,000 more times, but.
Yeah,
and twice.
Just so, in case my wife listens, I ordered it before I heard about the nudity part.
Yeah,
so
sure.
Just FYI. Mm-hmm. In fact, you can see it's pre-ordered.
Sure. So, Well, thanks, Cole. What have you been watching, Erica, or what did you watch?
We have been going to a Wim Wenders retrospective over the last, almost 2 months at this point?
Mm-hmm. And good timing for that.
Yeah. And it was a real discovery for me, not of Wim Wenders, but sort of filling in those titles that unfortunately have taken me, I guess at this point, too long to see. So the one that I really want to focus on is Paris, Texas. So I have to say, sadly, this was my first time seeing it. But I got the real treat of seeing it on the big screen in this beautiful digital restoration. Mm. It's pretty spectacular.
Beautiful movie, yeah. And I would not say sadly to that. I'd say you're lucky to see it the first time on 35mm. In fact, the poster is of the restoration that you have that you see. So, and I know you guys watched the Road Trilogy and some others, right?
We did.
And for me, tell me if you agree, Cole. I think Alice in the Cities was the huge standout for that, particularly because of Alice.
I was going to cheat, actually, and jump on your short take and throw that in if you didn't bring it up, because, yes, that was my favorite of the series. I would say Alice in the Cities at the very top for me, just beneath that, Kings of the Road, and then Wrong Move, the middle film, would be the least of the three, but still fantastic.
And we also got to see The American Friend, too.
Oh, that's
so
right.
Pretty
oh,
cool. Great.
Oh, that's great. Yeah.
So nice. I'm going to backtrack on saying, sadly, that was my first time and fully embrace it. because we've had a number of conversations about it being something that I think grows with time and with the age of the viewer. So I think I appreciate it much more now than I could have when I was 19, 20 sure. at the time when it came yeah. out.
What's weird is a lot of I'm in some film groups and I see a lot of millennials, and Paris, Texas is pretty well beloved. Now the Road Trilogy is not accessible to many, but I think that'll probably change, hopefully in the months to come. And by the way, I just so I can put my two cents in, I'll put Kings of the Road first, and then Alice, very very close, and then Wrong Move. Wrong Move is a little further down, but I saw a bad print of it, so. Got some old, was it Kino? Did they do those DVDs?
I think that's right.
And the color didn't spark as much on that, whereas the two black and white films, did the color look pretty good on the print?
Beautiful.
It did. This restoration, it's really interesting to see not only what the restoration has brought out of these, but to watch vendors and Robbie Mueller, his cinematographer's evolution as they go from Alice in the Cities to Wrong Move to Kings of the Road, and then it seems like a quantum leap to mm-hmm. Paris, Texas, and then Wings of Desire in terms of the quality of photography and shot composition. They were always good, but getting to watch them in order this way, you really get to see that blossom, and it was really fantastic.
Oh, cool. Well, hopefully we'll have the opportunity. I remember from Wrong Move a lot of tracking shots as they walk up hills, with very nice natural scenery, but of course that mine was grainy. I imagine that was pretty crisp and beautiful in the restoration.
Yeah. I wonder if that means that if Criterion would be, if that's a new restoration of Paris, Texas, if that means that we'll be getting that, you know, a re-release Blu-ray or something. But I mean, the one we have now looks gorgeous, but we'll see.
Yeah, there have been other restorations for existing films, and they haven't upgraded those. So I think those are probably lower priority for them, as much as I would love it. Although, you know, they're touring this, so it could happen.
Yeah, never know. I call Paris, Texas, the best American film from a non-American director. I just really love it. It was my first Vendors, and it's fantastic. Glad you got to see it finally, Erica.
Me too.
Good stuff. So I'm going to actually, you know, I was, for my short take, I was going to talk about Sicario because I did finally catch up with it, the Denis Villeneuve film, but I'm going to sub in because I had the pleasure of something that was a bit of a surprise to me. I wanted to watch something else from Linklater since we are talking about Slacker. So I went back to Me and Orson Welles just a few years ago, 2009 film, very different film to watch from Linklater because, you know, he's not the writer. He's really just the quote unquote, just the director. And it really is a Hollywood film. I felt like it was hard to kind of see his stamp on the movie overall. But I did like it more, really more than I expected. It has a higher critical rating than an audience rating from what I saw. Roger Ebert, I think, gave it 100. And there's some really good acting in it overall. I mean, it's really a perfect Wells by Christian McKay, and he just knocks it out of the park. And I think there's some of the way the film ends. I think it kind of, there's a high note at the end of the opening night that they could have maybe left on, and it kind of drags for another 10 minutes. But I did think that from an acting standpoint, unfortunately, Claire Danes was a little bit weak compared to some of the others. But overall, Zac Efron, I thought, was good, you know, for his role. So it's definitely worth checking out if you haven't seen it. And, of course, seeing someone portray Orson Welles is a lot of fun for Criterion fans, I think. So that's definitely recommended, Me and Orson Welles. Have any of you seen that one?
Yep.
I have. I liked it. I think my reaction was the same as yours. I liked it more than I thought I would.
I haven't seen it, unfortunately.
I'm just going to keep my mouth shut.
I think Aaron might have something else to say, but we'll move on to...
I think I was mixed on it, but I agree. Yeah. The impersonation, really, as much a performance as an impersonation, was good by that actor. But I actually don't remember it too well. I just remember...
It's, it's not one to revisit, I think. You know, it's probably a one and doner. So, you know, I can't blame you for not, for, you know, remembering it much. I'm sure it'll be out of my head soon.
Except it's no Jellyfish
Except
eyes.
For the performance. No. Exactly.
Oh, that's a classic. So, well, but you teased it. Did you like Sicario?
I did. This one I didn't like it as much as I expected to. So kind of the other way around. But
I just had to know.
Yeah, it's Emily Blunt. I like you better in Edge of Tomorrow and Looper. Like that character a little bit better. So and poor Roger Deakins. He's not going to win cinematography. That's all I'll say. So
I'm just going to say we're going to talk when we hang up this.
All right,
we're going to have another cast.
We'll have a long take on Sicario. So finally, how about you, Aaron? What's your short take?
This is tough of me to think of a few because I've watched a few that we're going to podcast soonish. I watched one Friday night that is going to be part of the little project we teased, and another one that I'm going to guest on next week. So I'll skip those. And I saw Animalisa by Charlie Kaufman.
Excellent.
And I would say I'm a Kaufman fan. In fact, I'm working on my 2008 list, and Synecdoche, New York is my number one on that list. Big fan of that film. It is dark, deep, depressing. That's depressing
the 3Ds,
is an understatement. Yeah. And this is as well, but I like, you know, Eternal Sunshine, Adaptation, you know, pretty much everything he's done. This one, actually, I didn't like as much. I was kind of disappointed. I just thought it was a little bit more mundane. I thought the animation was really strong. It's one I probably will revisit, and again, it's depressing. but I knew that going in, in a different way. It's about, you know, I guess middle age. And I've read some things after seeing it that leads me to believe there's a little more depth, as expected with a Kaufman piece. There's probably a lot more depth than I picked up on in the first watch. So maybe my mind will change. But for now, I'm a little more than mixed. I liked it, but didn't love it.
Cool. It's high on my list. I definitely want to see it at some point.
Have you guys seen that?
I have. I was lucky enough to see it at Fantastic Fest this year, back in September. I should say last year now, back in September of 2015. And it made my top 10 for the year. I really enjoyed it. It was...
Wow. I'm the wet towel today.
It was
nice.
Maybe a little bit of it being the festival atmosphere and also Charlie Kaufman being in attendance certainly didn't hurt. It made it a lot of fun. And so we got a little more insight into the creation of it and the process with the puppetry. And I found it really fascinating. Plus, I love David Thewlis and Jennifer Jason Leigh. I'm huge fans of both of them. And so it was right in my wheelhouse.
Yeah, their dynamic was really good. I thought it was really up until that point. Little things like, you know, showing them. Well, I don't want to go into too much detail for people that haven't seen it. So.
Cool. Well, that's it for our opening. Thank you for your short takes, Cole and Erica. We will transition into Slacker. We listened to the Butthole Surfers leading in, and we're going to listen to a little bit more of it. This is the credit music from the end of Slacker. So we'll take a listen to this, and we'll get into Richard Linklater's Slacker.
And it's weird.
Welcome back to Criterion Close-Up. I'm Mark Herney here with Aaron West and Cole and Erica from the Magic Lantern podcast. And I need to click here, guys. I've got this eBay bid on a Madonna pap smear. Got it.
That's listing, so thank you.
That had to be, from 1991 till now, how much had it appreciated? It had to be like $5,000,
It was, yeah. The winning bid was $5,000. So,
and Erica bought it off the Butthole Surfers drummer, who is also the cover.
Oh, it's good stuff. So if you didn't know, well, you knew from the before on the show what we're talking about, but this is Slacker, directed by Richard Linklater. I'd like to list the entire cast of this film, but I'm not going to do that because it's gigantic, and it'd be the rest of the cast to do that. This is Spine Number 247. It is out on DVD and also was released on Blu-ray. Blu-ray upgrade. Interesting difference with the supplements there. We'll talk about briefly later. It's interesting that it's a 4:3 aspect ratio. Mm-hmm. Did notice that. And just wanted to set it up briefly. It presents a day in the life of a loose-knit Austin, Texas subculture populated by eccentric, yes, very eccentric, and overeducated young people.
Well, some. So,
some of them. It's a little misleading there. It was shot on 16mm for $3,000. And so, as we mentioned, has over 100 characters. And it's, as Criterion says, a prescient look at an emerging generation of aggressive non-participants and one of the key films of American independent film in the 1990s. So, very much so.
Yeah. And so, don't you love the character names too?
Oh yeah, yeah. Just, it's as you go through some of the credits, it's classic. I'm trying to remember what was there.
Well, it starts with should have stayed at the bus station.
Yeah,
you're right.
Been on Mars yeah. since have, the 50s.
Yeah, Ultimate Loser, Dostoevsky, Wannabe, Scooby-Doo, Philosopher. Hand stamping arm liquor. This is some of the ones I noted.
There was
the aforementioned Pap Smear Pusher, of course.
Based on authoritative sources, and and then I think there was the contrast. That was the lady that before she went to the JFK guy.
Oh yeah,
yeah. Disgruntled grad student.
That's great.
Anarchist daughter working on same painting. Papa Smurf.
Yeah, some of them you see the name and you're trying to remember back to, you know, who the character was, because some of them you spend more time with, some, you know, very brief mention and sight of them. So, but why don't we, you know, talk a little bit about Richard Linklater before we talk about the film? And we do want to talk about Austin. You can't help but talk about the Austin backdrop without you know, when you're talking about Slacker. But Aaron, I'll kick it to you to talk, lead us into the Linklater discussion first.
Yeah, well, I'm a big fan of Linklater, but I think his origins are something we can relate to. You know, he basically was a film geek in Austin. Yeah. Well, Cole and Erica can relate extremely well to it. He was with the Film Society, got a couple lucky breaks, you could probably say. Didn't go to film school, as it's noted in the supplements. He went, he lived near a film school, but and sat in some classes, but didn't actually go.
Yep.
And, you know, he kind of, Slacker was his breakthrough. It still is a cult film, but this led to Dazed and Confused, which, you know, is also on Criterion, and that's a bigger budget, a cleaner narrative film, still also a cult film. Of course, the trilogy that I am partial to, and it's actually fitting for Valentine's Day, is the Before trilogy. Well, maybe not the last one is not as sweet, but Sunrise and Sunset are, you know, they're sort of, he kind of does indie studio, and with Austin, you know, with Slacker, he captured Austin, and with Sunrise, he captures Vienna pretty well, and then Sunset, of course, Paris, and then Greece, Athens in Midnight. But he's also, as you noted with Orson Welles, he's done some studio pictures. He's, you know, that's one of them. He did The Bad News Bears. he did Bernie. And
School of Rock.
School of Rock, yeah. And he's been relatively successful at that. However, I think his standout work is his independent self, the stuff he's written. Of course, Boyhood is, you know, the one that's... And in fact, I wonder if that might be the one he's remembered for, maybe that and the Before trilogy. So anyway, yeah. Slacker is a great intro to see where he's come from.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, it really, I think this movie is important to watch because he does have, he talks about this some too. It was on some of the, he actually is part of two commentaries on the disc, one for Slacker and one for his first film. And it really brings out how he is very, really studied literature, philosophy, theater very early on, and being self-taught. I think that comes through in a lot of those films. I mean, another one we didn't mention was Waking Life, where mm-hmm. he likes to, and of course with like the Before trilogy, he likes to walk and talk with his characters and let them kind of espouse on life and you know, anything. And you know, you get that in those films, in Waking Life, and it kind of, like you said, a culmination with Boyhood, which was, you know, for me personally, I mean, you could 2014, you could put Under the Skin and Boyhood. I'd take those two in that year and probably just leave the rest. I thought it was that good. So it'd be interesting to see where he goes from there.
Well, he's there. Actually, he's about to do, going to come out soon, the spiritual sequel to Dazed and Confused. I think it's coming out within the next month or two.
Yeah, that's right.
So, yeah, I shouldn't ask if you're fans, but you wouldn't be here if you weren't. But what are your feelings about Linklater?
My biggest treat in Linklater is the Before trilogy as well. I'm also a huge fan of School of Rock, and part of that is listening to his commentary, because you get a sense before, we've been lucky enough to see him in person and go to talks with him and see the work that he does through Austin Film Society. But even without that, you get that sense of what an inquisitive mind he has and how warm and inclusive and open-hearted he is.
Hmm.
Yeah, he seems like an actor's director, or really just an everyone's director. He just seems like an easy guy to get along with, and it sounds like he has very comfortable sets, which is a rarity in independent or studio film.
Yeah.
Deep thinker. So have you actually met him and talked to him, or just in these?
Actually, that's one of the great benefits to living here and being able to go to all these Austin Film Society events. He is really accessible. He is totally down to earth, very friendly, always excited to talk about movies. He still maintains that fandom, which is really nice to see that he hasn't outgrown that or left it behind. It still informs everything he does. For me, from my end of things, I really like the more experimental parts of what he does. Slacker is probably far and away my favorite, but I really enjoyed the first film also.
Plow.
And what I like best about him is that inquisitiveness, like you were talking about, Erica. That how successful he is as an autodidact, basically, that really appeals to me. That's indie spirit that he embodies. It's not just a pose. It's something that he has lived for as long as he can remember, most likely.
Without going into the self-important category,
right, exactly.
That is some criticism that was levied at Slacker. And I will say, I do still put Boyhood at the top of the entire list.
Yeah, that should come out from Criterion. They're fandom pages, so I think it's probably going to come out this year.
Yeah, that would be great.
Yeah,
that'll be nice. Don't quote me on that, but I'm pretty optimistic.
Yeah, we assume it will.
I should mention also. I'm sorry, Mark didn't.
No, go ahead, Cole.
Okay, I should mention also that one of the great things that I've picked up from him, he hosts a series called Jewels in the Wasteland every year at Austin Film Society, and he is teaching me now, it feels like, even though I'm the autodidact that he sort of is. It's really nice to have him as a resource, not just as a celebrity that you occasionally get to interact with. He puts on these series of screenings every summer where the theme is basically the overlooked films of certain periods of the 80s. And just those little things that he's done in the last couple of years have really been beneficial to my film education. It's been a real blast to get to see what he's chosen and how come. It's like he does his own little podcast there once a week for eight weeks and shows some of the greatest films.
What any selections that come to mind?
The one that really floored me, the one that really sticks with me still, is Cutter's Way. I had never seen it, and I just
that one's
fell in love with that thing.
That's coming from Twilight Time, I believe.
It's a great film. I highly recommend picking that up in any format.
Yeah. I was kind of on the fence. I'd heard mixed things, but yeah. Yeah, no.
Cole seal of approval.
Absolutely.
And in the movie, there's lots of references to film. I think, was there a reference to Fassbender?
You'll see all sorts of things. And what you'll see, I think my favorite thing, John Hurd's performance in it as this sort of Tom Waitsian rascal.
Oh, wow.
Right. Yeah.
It's so good. It's so funny and clever and at times melancholy. It's fantastic.
Hmm. You're right, Aaron. It is coming from Twilight Time in April. So I saw it.
Wow. I'm all about April releases today.
Yeah. Very nice. So why don't we, let's transition into, you talked a little bit about Austin and would like to hear more about the Austin scene, of course, the Austin Film Society that Richard Linklater was a part of, spawning, if I am remembering correctly. So I'll turn it back to you guys. Tell us a little bit about the scene. Help us set this up a little bit.
Well, he's still a very active part of it, actually. It's been really interesting to watch it grow since I got here. In 2002 is when I moved to Austin. And in the last 14 years now, I guess, it's gone from a fun but still fairly small operation to the point now where the Film Society is able to provide grants for people, studio space to work, all sorts of resources for budding filmmakers. And a lot of that is... you can trace that directly to Linklater's influence and direct participation. This is one of the greatest towns I've ever lived in or ever would want to live in as far as just the amount of cinema that's available to us all the time. In addition to Austin Film Society, we have one of the greatest theater chains in the world based here, the Alamo Drafthouse.
Drafthouse. And I envy you.
Can we take a road trip, Aaron? I'm ready.
I'm moving.
Yeah, you guys are welcome. Anytime. We will go to the movies nonstop if you guys come down. There's always something fun and different and interesting. It is a great place to be a cinephile.
Well, Andrea and I have talked about traveling there, long before this podcast. We just think Austin's a cool city. I've been to the heart of Texas, but it's kind of an outlier, I think, culturally, well, definitely politically. There's music, as you mentioned. There's Austin City Limits, South by Southwest, movies. It seems like a hotbed. So
the food scene, too, actually has really exploded over the last several years. So if you're in any sort of foodie also, it is one of the great places to be.
When my wife hears this cast, I think that sold her. I think we're we're planning our trip. She's a major foodie. So.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah. Yeah. And movies, the music scene
music,
as well.
Food.
Nice. And you have a band you mentioned.
I do. I play in a band called Some Say Leland. If you listen to our podcast, the opening and closing title music for our show, that's actually music that my band makes.
It's very pleasing. In fact, I wanted to ask you what song that was because I felt like I'd heard it before but couldn't place it. And, well, I hadn't heard it before.
We try to be very cinematic.
Some Say Leland.com. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I'm going to check it out. Brought Low is the latest album.
Yeah, that is the most recent record.
Cool.
Nice.
And have you played, any of the Austin festivals or anything or the clubs? I'm sure you have.
Yeah, we try to not oversaturate the place, obviously, since you could feasibly play every weekend somewhere. But
oh, wow, yeah.
Because there are literally... hundreds of places to go play music, and that's not even during South by Southwest. During South by Southwest, every hotel lobby, corner of a bookstore,
parking lot,
yeah, it all becomes a venue.
Basement.
Oh, that's cool. What about Woodshock? Have you ever played Woodshock?
Unfortunately, I missed that. Watching that supplement, I was so regretful. I was probably 11 during the very first one, so I wouldn't have been able to get here, but I wish I could have been a part of that.
You didn't have a band when you were 11?
It took me until I was 15, probably.
Okay.
Oh, okay. But I had an air guitar band when I was 11, so that was my thing.
No, I'm a huge Jesus Lizard fan, and I thought it was interesting to note that in that supplement that David Yao from the Jesus Lizard, and before that, Scratch Acid, another great Austin band, designed that first poster.
Your poster?
No, for Woodshock.
Oh, Woodshock, right. I'm sorry. yeah, that was interesting. Does that still happen, Woodshock?
No, that has long since gone the way of the buffalo. I think the coolest thing that's closest to that now is probably a festival called Levitation. That is a major psych festival that Rocky Erickson plays every year now.
Oh, wow. Okay. 13th floor elevators, yeah. For people that don't know. And what was neat about, we're already talking about supplements, but Daniel Johnston is probably a major fixture there still.
He is, and just as sweet and lovable a guy as you could possibly imagine.
That's what I expected. Mark, are these people familiar to you at all? Or
No.
Okay.
Unfortunately.
Yeah, I think Cole and I have more in common musically.
I think so. I think we're going to have to go down there, Aaron, and just, you know, spend some time, hang out, and do a live show or something in Austin. So,
sure.
Let's book it.
Let's go for South by Southwest.
Yeah.
Or
there
come
we go.
Down for Fantastic Fest.
Yeah.
That's going to be the big treat.
Okay. Is that more of like an art film kind of thing? Or?
It's more of a genre film kind of thing. It is 8 days of just wall to wall madness. The craziest, most outlandish things, in addition to things like Anomalisa and Green Room.
Oh, sure.
There are major anticipated titles, but what's filling in the gaps there is just some of the craziest world cinema that you could possibly imagine. Mm.
Cool.
So let's get into a little bit of the movie, of course. We wanted to talk about, I mean, you can't help but talk about Slacker and get into the structure a bit. I think really the best person to lead us into talking about the structure a little bit is the, let's play the clip where we've actually got Linklater is playing an actor, and he's coming, he's in a taxi cab and talking about his dreams. So why don't we play that clip, which, you know, again, it leads into the film. The film starts with him on a train, and then we see him talking to the cabbie, who doesn't really care much, it seems like, about what he has to say, but he does talk about parallel universes and dreams. So let's play that clip.
I just had it. It was just like that, except instead of anything bizarre going on, I mean, there was nothing going on at all. Man. It was like the Omega Man. There was just nobody around. I was just traveling around, you know, staring out the windows of buses and trains and cars, you know. When I was at home, I was like flipping through the TV stations endlessly, reading. I mean, how many dreams do you have where you read in a dream, you know? Wait. Man, there was this book I just read on the well, you know, it was my dream, so I guess I wrote it or something. But, man, it was bizarre. It was like the premise for this whole book was that every thought you have creates its own reality. You know, it's like every choice or decision you make, the thing you choose not to do fractions off and becomes its own reality, you know, and just goes on from there forever. I mean, it's like, you know, in The Wizard of Oz, when Dorothy meets the Scarecrow and they do that little dance at that crossroads and they think about going all those directions, then they end up going in that one direction. I mean, all those other directions, just because they thought about it, became separate realities. I mean, they just went on from there and lived the rest of their life, you know? Just, I mean, entirely different movies, but we'll never see it because, you know, we're kind of trapped in this one reality restriction type of thing, you know?
And is this the same guy from the previous film? Probably a lot of people haven't seen Plow.
Right. No, that's a good, yeah, I didn't even think about that. Of course, his first film, It's Impossible to Learn to Plow by Reading Books, that's from 88. Mm-hmm. Linklater plays himself again, basically sets up a camera, and I shouldn't say plays himself, but he plays a character really unnamed, and this character is unnamed too, really just the dream guy. So, yeah, wonder if there's some symmetry there.
But in his monologue, he talks about how he had just been riding in trains and cars and reading, and, you know, sounds familiar, and buses, and of course that's where he got off, and actually I think he kind of mentioned that in the commentary. Does that sound right?
Yeah, I can't remember if he mentions that for sure. He does talk about how, you know, this film specifically in the commentary is in Slacker is really asking, you know, what if characters were to speak their inner monologues out loud? Mm-hmm. You know, so you wonder how much of this is really, you know, the did he write? Did some of the characters come up with themselves as part of, you know, what they were saying? It's pretty interesting.
I think it was a little of both. I think he wrote a lot of it, but like for example, the pap smear scene, that pap smear part he wrote, but then
someone else gave him that idea from what I remember. But he did, you know, he incorporated it into the film.
But the actress that played that part, the story about her in traffic and the guy that I guess took his own life after an accident, was that what happened? Mm-hmm. That was a story she actually knew and told. So I think they were a little of both.
Definitely a combination there.
Cole, Erica, do you remember?
Yeah, I think that's exactly how it went. Teresa Taylor brought him that story.
Taylor, thank you.
Mm-hmm. A few years before, actually, Slacker, and he recalled her spinning that yarn at some point and thought, oh, that would be a great story, stuck it away in his mental Rolodex, and then eventually it reared its head in that episode.
And another example with Kalman, who was the student who has the TVs, and he's got the TV mm-hmm. taped to his back, he tells the story about reading through the script and not really having a hold on those lines. And so mm-hmm. he went out with Rick and sat on the steps and rewrote every single line to make it something that he would do more true to his character.
Oh, sure.
And the JFK guy was actually a JFK conspiracy theorist. So mm-hmm. I'm willing to bet that probably 75% of that, if not all of it, was coming from him. So yeah, I think I like that collaborative, you know, with without professionals, I think people did pretty well, given that it is one, you know, you follow one person and then you follow another person as they interact. So,
yeah,
do you guys think it's a dream like Linklater, that, or not a dream but another
new reality,
all possible right. realities,
yep. mm-hmm.
right?
I do yeah. and I don't. The thing that strikes me the most, the moment when the housemates are looking at the postcards left behind from the roommate who has left, mm-hmm. and one of them is, there's too much direct evidence against uniqueness. And I feel like this is also his presentation of uniqueness. So mm-hmm. whether it's all possible realities or let's just do something completely different in narrative structure and building character, that's less about motivation and more about humanity. Any of those things are possible.
Yeah. No. Could be all of the above. I think probably a little experiment of his that I think worked.
Yeah. I think there was a movie I wanted to bring up too, because you had mentioned this on a recent episode, Aaron. To call it the Boonwell effect.
I know where you're going.
With the Phantom of Liberty, where and it's funny, Roger Ebert actually brought this up in his review too, how you follow one story or a scene for so long, and then the character bumps into another group, and then we spin off and follow them for a while, mm-hmm. Which happens there, and so really until the end of the movie, and so you kind of have a sense of this being like a Buñuel film, almost a different reality, almost surreality in some of the interactions that they have. It's interesting. It's a kind of a mix of, some of it seems realistic, some of it is just seems so far out there as to not be realistic. I mean, I wonder how many, you know, like we said before, Madonna pap smears are actually on eBay. But
it's funny you mentioned that scene is actually playing as I'm watching, and I just saw a boom mic. So if I seem distracted, I'm trying to find that boom mic again. Oh, there it is. Yeah. It is an amateur production, you know.
Oh yeah.
Compared to later works.
The camera is too, I wonder if you guys thought about this. I just, you know, from a structure standpoint, the camera is almost like someone walking down the street, and like you're that person that mm-hmm. bumps into somebody, and the difference is you don't really have the opportunity to interact. I mean, Linklater doesn't interact with the people. He just lets it go. Obviously, he's the director, and he wrote some of it. But from a camera standpoint, as I think Lee Daniels shot this, that it's really just another person. So curious. I mean, I guess I wanted to ask you, Cole, is that part of, is the structure part of why you like this film so much from Linklater, or is it something else?
It is. It's really impressive to me how assured this is for what is essentially a first film.
Sure.
You watch how fluid those transitions are, and you realize this guy had this whole thing very much worked out in his head and has been thinking about this a long time for it to translate so successfully onto the screen. It's a really great technical achievement for $23,000, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm coming into it, rewatching it, and I think it only gets better. It's incredibly rewatchable when the things, oh, yeah, sort of minus the boom mic moment, which is pretty charming more than anything. I think you see the crane work that, mm-hmm, I didn't occur to me the first time I saw it, and how wonderful the tracking work is.
The tracking is great, and there's a mixture of tracking and handheld. Sure. But it seems to flow with the characters, and the characters seem to dictate the filmmaking. The one thing that you mentioned with the screen is it being 4:3. Sometimes, like wide shots, you don't see it. As I mentioned, I'm seeing the pap smear scene, and it almost kind of looks like the old pan and scan VHSs, mm-hmm, where the camera has to move from one character to another. It can't capture them wide. So I think that's a limitation, but that's probably more about the inexpensive production rather than anything deliberate.
Yeah, it almost makes sense with this movie too, because it is more maybe less large and cinematic and more kind of compact and focused on these characters specifically. So I wrote that. It was like the first thing I put in my notes was like 4:3, why? But I think it works for this film for sure. Any random, one of the things that we'd mentioned was the randomness of the characters and who we bump into. And some of it is just so fluid in how it just, the camera just stops, someone walks by and it stops and picks someone else up. But from the, like we mentioned, Madonna pap smear, we've mentioned the JFK, and maybe we should play the Madonna pap smear scene now just to kind of lead us into this a little bit more.
Oh yeah, I know what I gotta show you guys, man. This will blow your gourd. I have this friend, all right? She's a gynecologist in Hollywood, and she scored this for me from the lab where she works. It's a Madonna pap smear. I know it's kind of cloudy, but it's a Madonna pap smear. It's got Ciccone on the top. That's like a medical label, Ciccone. Check it out. I know it's kind of disgusting, but it's sort of like getting down to the real Madonna. I don't know if you can see it now. I freaked out when it came in the mail. It had two pubic hairs in it, and I showed it to this asshole, and he stole one of them. But if you look real close, you can see it's still in there. It's about as black as they come. Do you think maybe you'd be interested in buying something like this? It's like a high dollar item. It's one of a kind. It's like chance of a lifetime.
Yeah.
So I mean, this is it's a scene where you have three characters: the ultimate loser guy, the Madonna pap smear person kind of walks up, and one of my favorite scenes is with the ultimate loser, where he talks about how he's got a band practice in 5 hours, so he's going to head out now, and
mm-hmm, right.
He's got nothing else to do but walk over to band practice, which certainly gets into the characters and just their random day-to-dayness, and like we mentioned before at the lead-in, just how much time it seems like folks have. So
should mention that those two characters are from a local band, an indie band at the time, or I guess alt rock is what they called it back then, called Glass Eye. And then Teresa, the pap smear, she was a drummer for Butthole Surfers for a little while, and in fact she played on the track, the opening track. So a lot of musicians in this movie, and I think that again, I know I just took you in a different direction, but it's as much rooted in Austin music and film culture as everything else.
Yeah. Any scenes, in that vein or randomness that stuck out to you, Cole and Erica?
Well, the one thing that always occurs to me, especially when I'm reading synopsis of the film or any sort of critical breakdown, that people often mention how eccentric the characters are. Let me clear that up from an Austin perspective, there is nothing eccentric about any of these people, as far as I'm concerned.
I'm wondering about that.
With the people that I work with and make music with and have grown to know and love for the decade plus that I've lived in this town, that's par for the course. This is nothing out of the ordinary to run into these sorts of coffee shop philosophers and crackpots and conspiracy theorists. In fact, my job, I manage a Half Price Books, which is one of the locations that's featured in the film. I actually work for that company, and I have one customer in particular who is very much my pet conspiracy theorist. I have one guy that I talk to on a really regular basis that tells me most sincerely some of the craziest stories you could possibly imagine, and it's one of the highlights of my workday.
Oh, wow.
Is that the bookshop where the JFK conspiracy?
Yes.
Is that the same one?
It's not the same one. Amazing. It's the same company.
Same chain.
You started close to that location.
Right. That location moved to a larger location, which is the one I started at.
Maybe we should go ahead and play some JFK nonsense.
Sure.
Well, maybe it's not nonsense. I don't know. I wasn't there.
He's well-versed, so...
You know me. I've been keeping up with my JFK assassination theories, you know.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't know.
You know, you're reading one of the great books on the subject. It's great. Rush of Judgment, you know, has all that testimony, you know, from of all the witnesses who were never called before the Warren Commission. Huh. You know, like Mrs. Aquila Clemens, who was that maid who lived on Patton Street, who saw the Tippit shooting, you know, and it wasn't Oswald that did it, of course. You know, it was Jack Ruby.
Oh, really?
Oh,
I
yes.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah. Yeah. This is also the book that's got the testimony of Sam Holland, you know, the Prince of the Puff of Smoke.
Huh.
Yeah, he was up there on the overpass over Dealey Plaza, you know, and he was able to just see everything, you know.
I really don't know too much about this. I was kind of just flipping through.
It's really good. But if you like that, you should really read one of the other books around here. It might be here. Best Evidence. That's the one, you know, with all the head snap stuff in it.
Oh, yeah?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Oh, yeah. And of course, then if you like that, then you should really read, like, 6 Seconds in Dallas, because, you know, 6 Seconds is the one that's got all the trajectories and the triangulation of the bullets and stuff. And it's great. It's just got this, like, second-by-second account of just the entire tragic sequence, you know?
That's fascinating.
So have you met that guy in your wanderings?
Unfortunately, no, but several people like him, most definitely.
That's funny. Yeah, I mean, you've kind of already, you know, brought it up a bit there, Cole. I mean, I'm curious how, you know, if you guys have any more anecdotes or thoughts about how Austin is, it's one of the notes we had, how Austin is featured in the film. It sounds like it's accurate, at least from that level, that culture.
It is, and I moved here in 2004, so 2 years after Cole got here. And I would say that the difference in the city from that early 1990s period to the early 2000s saw less change than the amount of time since then. So now the skyline is completely different. The makeup of the city is quite a bit different, but the college town aspect remains to an extent. So when I got here, you could still see the streets look the same. You could travel around and kind of identify some places, but now not so much. But I'll also say that, down to the question of how realistic this might be or not, and kind of the coffee shop philosophers, I am from a similar college town, and the time that I grew up in these early 90s, I met those same people. I talked to those same people, and so I don't think it matters so much. It is definitely an Austin movie, but it's a little bit broader than that. And so it doesn't also feel like these are kooky eccentrics. These feel like conversations I've had.
Yeah.
Well, a couple hours away is Asheville, North Carolina, which is a little similar to Austin. And every city has their little cultural coffee shop hotspot. I spent some time in Atlanta, and they have Little Five Points in Virginia Highlands. And Mark, Burlington probably has some kookiness, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, plenty of kookiness here. Actually, where I grew up in the Central Vermont area, right next to the capital of Montpelier and working at a record store called Exile on Main Street, named after the Rolling Stone album.
Nice.
It's just like Cole said, you have some people that come in every day, you're eccentrics, or you have people that come in once a week, like you can just count on them coming in on a Friday, and you'll have some really amazing, sometimes deep, sometimes just off the wall conversations that really make your day. I totally agree.
And that little documentary, the Vive Les Amis, that was probably filmed about the time that you arrived in Austin, right, Erica? Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And so I was actually wondering, of course, that showed rapid change just since Slacker, and that had been only, a little more than a decade. So what kind of changes since then have taken place?
As I mentioned, that the skyline for me is the biggest issue. When we got here, nothing was too tall. Mm-hmm. Not really. We had a couple of big buildings, but now we've got these gigantic high rises. The roads are totally different. When I landed here, I was on 6th Street, which is essentially sort of the never-ending Mardi Gras of Austin. And I could walk around and I could go to Waterloo, where Cole was working at the time, though we didn't know each other. I could walk all over the place and see this greenery, and now it's unrecognizable. When we go down south to go to something, I don't know where anything is.
Is it more, of course, South by Southwest is a huge festival and destination. Is it becoming like a... like just crowded, or people trying to flood the culture, or trying to being attracted by the culture, and is it becoming more homogenized?
I don't know that the culture is the big draw. It is more about money now. It's more about Dell is here, and so with that first tech boom, it brought in a lot of those folks. It wasn't anyone.
Okay.
It wasn't bohemians trying to find their oasis. It's since then it's been a lot about. Money and career and rapid expansion and growth, much more than trying to find some place to fly your freak flag.
See, I thought it was Burning Man, Texas, is what I thought.
Other parts of Texas will tell you that.
And the thing that originally brought me here is, I guess, not the thing that's attracting people in the same way as you mentioned. I was going to come... originally, when I got out of school, for film. I didn't at the time. I went to Los Angeles. I went to Baltimore and did theater for a long time, and then came here from Los Angeles thinking in the back of my mind, I'm not going to do film anymore probably, but I know I have that option. And I don't see people coming because they heard how great Austin Film Festival is, or Fantastic Fest, or Austin Film Society.
I guess that's just us. We think, oh, okay, that's why we'd go.
Right.
We don't care about Dell. No, nothing personal against Michael Dell and what he's done for your community.
The thing about Austin now is that makes it so difficult for example, to make a film like Slacker in 2016 is how much more expensive it is to live here. These places, there have always been... if Aaron probably relates to this, before Austin, for me, there was a place like Athens, Georgia, or before Athens, there was a place like Minneapolis, where these scenes sprang up. And what really makes that possible is place where artists can go and live cheaply and not have to be concerned with the day-to-day grind of just making a living, because their rent is now $1,400 a month as opposed to $200.
And
that's a good point,
when Teresa was talking about trying to find Chico over on the east side because he's really interested in buying that pap smear, Chico can't live on the east side anymore.
Yeah, he's been priced out.
Yeah,
it's gentrified.
Definitely.
Sorry, Chico. But the pap smear market must be just booming.
That will never end.
Do you ever see Slacker? Obviously, it's an Austin movie, but is it popular in the community? Does it come up?
It's beloved here, I feel like. They did a remake of it in 2011.
Really?
That was sort of an homage to it. They filmed 24 different directors, I think. Each filmed a different segment of it.
Wow.
And the whole community took part in it. People here really embrace that.
What's funny is Linklater mentioned, I think he called it the anti Chamber of Commerce film because it does not show the beautiful lakes and definitely actually I don't even think we see the skyline in the film.
Yeah, not really.
You see it for a second.
Yeah, there's
then
a pan across before the happy-go-lucky guy walks into the G&M Steakhouse. Mm-hmm. It sort of pans across and you see one, maybe two buildings where now you see 50.
It's crazy. And then at the very end, they get out of the city and go get in the water, which is pretty great. But yeah,
someone could make a documentary about that. Changes.
Oh, okay. They probably have, actually. I don't know. I think we might be going.
Yeah.
I love how quotable this movie is, too.
Of course. Yeah.
I am not going to traumatize women anymore. A medical doctor told me that's I should stop.
When you're in a cafe.
The thing about the anti-Chamber of Commerce thing, though, after I've thought about that for a while, it hit me right where I live is the thing. I watched this then in 1991 when I was living in a small town in Oklahoma and was really taken by it. And even more since then, I go back and watch these supplements now. And for instance, there's that scene in the supplements, the outtake, where the two guys are coming out of the back door of the theater where they've just come from the Oshima film, and they're talking to each other about their plans for the evening, and one of them says, oh, the video store just got some new Von Sternberg in. And I see that now, and I think, oh, these are my people. This is very much a Chamber of Commerce piece for me. This is where I need to live.
Yeah, me too. They also mentioned, I remember there's a blow-up was mentioned later, and mimes playing tennis. So yeah, that's where I want to live too. Okay, we're doing a podcast about how we want to move to our guest house.
Well, I wonder, really too, if, I mean, you talked about being able to live there and, artists being able to live there and, fostering that culture. I wonder, Linklater, if he were to be getting his start now, if he could survive and, be there and making films, the way he did back then. I mean, you see a lot of that in this film and, of course, in Plow, how he put this film together, especially that film, and he made it over a year, again, jumping into the supplements again. But just, it makes me think, how that kind of, could he actually survive as a filmmaker, or would he have to go to, New York or Los Angeles? It's interesting.
That's a good question. I don't know. It's changing with, the Kickstarters and so if he had a community, and maybe Austin Film Society would be that community, maybe could get a film made. The big question is whether it could catch on. It happens. I don't know.
I think it illustrates that point, like I was mentioning about Athens and Minneapolis before Austin. There's always going to be, and there always has been, a disenchanted generation that is going to find a way to make the thing that's important to them and to do the thing that they love, which is really heartening to me, being as I'm one of those people. Mm-hmm. It's belonging to that whole continuum of youth rebellion, I guess, that, at one point was beatniks, at one point was hippies, and then moved into the 90s underground and then beyond. I feel like if you're not finding those things still, you're just not trying hard enough. There's a kid out there somewhere who has scraped together a way to do the thing that is going to eventually make a big difference to a small group of people.
Yeah, sure. We're the audience, but there's a lot of us out there.
Yeah.
Hence Slacker's popularity through the years. And I guess the question is, a lot of indie directors do springboard small projects. People working on superhero films started as indie directors. Mm-hmm. So it does happen.
Yeah.
And now we have the opportunity to see so many more things because of digital means and streaming and other platforms. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. So I think it's even possibly better now. Now, would it get the same distribution deal? No. But an opportunity for more people to see it who are looking for it.
Right. And the way that technology and its lowered cost and availability has kind of democratized the process. That kid in 1991 that couldn't afford a Panaflex can now go out and rent a Red One camera and shoot something that is professional quality.
Yeah. Or on an iPhone.
Tangerine,
yeah. But something has to, Linklater deserves credit for, even though he's dabbled with the studios, for sticking to his artistic guns and, continuing to do the films he feels passionate about. And yeah. I think if you just look over his filmography, you can probably tell which ones are ones for them and which ones are for him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it kind of stands out for sure. But
even the ones that he does for studios are you know, he picks good projects. Some might argue Bad News Bears, maybe not so much, but I liked it.
I would argue in favor of Bad News Bears because I think the thing that really illustrates that is that he was true to the original spirit of the first one. They didn't make it glossy. They didn't change the ending. It was still as offbeat and somewhat politically incorrect as the first one was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I definitely so with Billy Bob Thornton and his character. Actually, I'd say he was more politically incorrect because in 2000, whatever, you could be.
Mm-hmm.
Well, no, I shouldn't say that. This was the 70s we're talking about, but it was a kid's film.
Yeah.
Yeah, speaking of the 70s and, you know, and Oshima earlier, the scene that they showed on the TV was supposed to be in the realm of the senses, but they had to replace it, and he filmed his own nude scene that was his only nude scene ever. I thought that was it. Lots of film nuggets in this, so yeah.
Yeah. So before we, you know, kind of move into our film ratings as we're going along, just curious what you guys think about the message of the film, what it's trying to say. Again, know this really resonated for you, so I'll turn it to either one of you, Cole, Erica. What did you think about the message?
I think the message was delivered. I love the fact that it was delivered by a random draw of a card. That whole notion of withdrawing in disgust is not the same as apathy. That is the thing that really resonates with me, and I love the fact that the delivery method of the main, most important message was random chance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's good.
Living a meaningful life, I guess, is the overall thing that I take from it.
Right. Meaningful for you.
Exactly.
Personally, yeah.
To not be bound to that track of college, degree, career, family. If you, mm-hmm. if that doesn't speak to you, if that doesn't appeal to you, to be able to carve a path for yourself and make something meaningful for yourself based on what is important to you.
Yeah, it's mentioned in the Les Amis trailer. Really just gets to the heart of that, what you said, Cole, about people who are not so interested in career, education, and family, but just more interested in existing, seeing what comes around at that level, but, you know, being able to kind of chase their passions, you know, more, even more so. So I'm definitely with you. Any other thoughts on the message, Erica?
I'm going to go back again to something I mentioned earlier. That postcard, that's the thing that has struck mm-hmm. me the most. There's too much direct evidence against uniqueness. And fighting against that with this peculiar brand of active non-participation mm-hmm. and how to get to something deeper and more meaningful and more interesting and more exciting and more provoking and more insane and rude and whatever it is.
Yeah. How about you, Aaron?
Well, as I mentioned, this movie is very quotable, and one quote I found was, I may live badly, but at least I don't have to work to do it.
That's it. Yep.
So
that's a great quote.
But I don't think it's just about not working. You know, some characters do work and function. Mm-hmm. I think it's more just living, indulging however you want. I think... And that everybody's different, that, you know, one person may be an anarchist and another person may be a conspiracy theorist. Yeah. That, you know, there's lots of schools of thoughts out there and there's a connecting point for all of them.
Give that anarchist a cigarette. Yeah, I one thing I thought of, and it actually kind of ties into Fat Girl a little bit, that part of it is kind of it's about people who you do and sometimes do not come in contact with. I mean, there's a lot of those crisscrossing moments where people are walking down the street and the camera chooses to follow, you know, pick up and follow this person as there's some connection. Either they walk past each other, maybe they said hello, maybe there was an interaction. And so, you know, you think about all the interactions that you really kind of miss through your day-to-day lives, all these people you could come in contact with. And if you were, you know, like the man who said that we've been on the moon since the 50s, if you were just, you know, able to strike up that conversation, whether it's wanted or not, you know, that you could do that. And I felt that a little bit in Fat Girl, too, when we were, we'll of course, cover that more in that review, but there are those moments like on the freeway where you see the cars kind of passing by and they come in contact with people that they don't interact with. And I think it's just kind of that, talking about that culture of all these people in the world that, you know, may have something to say, we may have something in contact with, but we never, connect with. So making time for that.
And kind of good. From it. One thing I love so much about this film, further to your point, Mark, is that every character listens. I think it's easy to say, somebody's just going on and they don't care, or the taxi driver doesn't care. But he's looking at him and he's listening to him, and they'll often respond. And it's a very inclusive thing to do, to listen.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And the lady with the JFK conspiracy, I mean, she's not really into JFK conspiracies, but she does give him a chance. Of course, then she says, I have to leave for a movie, which we know is 2 hours later.
But right. She's had enough after a little while. But
yeah.
Right.
I mean, how much could we take?
Yeah. It's interesting, though, how watching those interactions, like you mentioned, the thing that really strikes me is how, like, in addition to paying attention, they're doing it with no judgment. Is the thing that I really enjoy mm-hmm. about watching yep. those. Like Aaron mentioned in the bookstore with the JFK theorist, she really is, it's genuine. Her interest is genuine, and she's not making any decision, it doesn't feel like, about this guy, who he is, what he's about. She's just taking it in. They mention in the commentary, Linklater does, what an interesting physical space is, the geography of the location that they shot in, and this is still true today, where you have a physical overlap between downtown, which is where the state government is, the college campus, and then right, a mental right. hospital. And how, as you're just walking down that sidewalk, the person that comes up to you with whatever it is that they're trying to say could be a rogue government employee, could be an overly caffeinated college student, could be someone who has just been released from the mental hospital. And so you have to listen equally to all three to determine what it is that you're going to take from this.
Yeah, great place to people watch, I think, for sure.
And another listening sequence, I think, is with the anarchist, with the person robbing him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the scene starts mm-hmm. with him robbing his house. Actually, I don't know how he got there, but, you know, he's robbing his house. And then, put the gun down, let me take it from you, let me tell you about anarchism and the guy that killed William McKinley. And he does mm-hmm. listen. Actually, I think he does buy that message. Who knows where he's going to take it? Fortunately, we don't stay on his storyline too long. But
yeah. So I think we should grade this thing. Curious. I mean, and, you know, Erica Cole, you can have a joint grade, or, you know, separate grades if you kind of feel about the film differently. What, and we usually do, you know, 1 to 10. What would you give Slacker as a film rating?
I'm gonna go with 7.5.
All right.
I can't commit myself to a 7 or 8, and I think it is something that, as I mentioned, is eminently rewatchable, and I think only gets better with time. But it's so important for film itself, less than what the piece of filmmaking is, but it's also terrific at the same time. So that's where I'm in the middle.
I go a little bit higher. I'm going to go bump it up just a half to an 8. It's obviously not one of the greatest, most accomplished pieces of cinema ever, but in terms of achieving what it sets out to do, it's really fantastic at that. And like Erica mentions, it is really important, I think, more so not as an artifact, because it kind of has a timeless quality, mm-hmm. but sure. the space it occupies in film history, I think, is at least as important as what you see happening on the screen.
Hmm. What about you, Aaron?
I think I'm with Cole. I also give it an 8. As Erica mentioned, it's not the most accomplished. Or, I'm sorry, did you say that, Cole? Or
I think I did.
Okay, yeah. Sorry, I can't tell you two apart.
It's great commentary.
I'd say it's, even though it's not the best piece of film, and as a film buff, I could pick it apart, you know, if I wanted to, but it is eminently rewatchable. It is a lot of fun. In fact, we could not possibly get through all the supplements. I watched the Linklater commentary, And I was tempted to watch the cast and crew, but I decided I want to save those because I want to come back to this film. So I'm also saying an 8. However, if, you know, maybe in 1991, I would have maybe thought it as an interesting experiment, you know, not knowing where it would lead. I'd go 7 or even maybe 6, you know, just maybe a curiosity. But yeah. No, I think today it's an important film, if not maybe not Linklater's greatest film.
Yeah, I'm okay, so I'm going to side with Erica on this one then, because I'm with her. I think it, on first watch, I probably would have given it a 6, 6.5. I've bumped it up to a 7.5 because I, again, agree. I think it gets better, and the more you delve into supplements, as always with Criterion,
sure,
it gets better. And I think I've never seen a film like this, quite like this. It does show a budding filmmaker. Linklater does get better. It's interesting to watch this for what we know comes later, how we talked about the philosophizing and, you know, walking, philosophizing while walking, I call it. Before trilogy and Waking Life. So yeah, for me it's 7.5, really solid film. But let's get into, you know, briefly about the supplements. You mentioned it, Aaron, it is a stacked release, so much so that we could not get through all of it. We were talking offline a bit how the script is there, like the original script called No Longer Not Yet. They're showing Life, which is getting into the casting of Slacker and the cast interviews. Mm-hmm. There is Taco and a half After 10, kind of a behind the scenes rough footage there. Ain't no film in that bleep, which is 13
mirrored
13 scenes, alternate takes. There's a trailer. End of interview, that's footage from the 2001 10-year anniversary. I thought it was great. I kind of expected to see... Well, no, actually, I was going to say you guys weren't there yet. The Les Amis trailer, 10-minute trailer, longest trailer I've ever seen. Mm-hmm. That's about the location there, a cafe close to the University of Texas. We mentioned Woodshock. That was a short film against 16mm that Linklater and Lee Daniels shot in 85 about that music festival. And we mentioned it includes his first film, so it's got a short and his first film, It's Impossible to Learn to Plow by Reading Books from 1988, which also includes a commentary and some references to films. The Killing is in there from Kubrick. We've also got Gertrude in there, the Dreyer film. So he's obviously a film fan. And, you know, we mentioned the commentaries, director, cast, and crew, all back to Slacker. And also wanted to mention, this actually came up online on social media, how there are some DVD features not included on the Blu-ray. So if you're a fan, you may want to consider, you know, grabbing both. One of them is the one that stood out was information about the Austin Film Society. That Linklater and Daniel found in 85 and includes some early flyers from screenings. Cole had shown one of those online that has a picture from Sallow. So, yeah, any comments about the supplements, Cole and Erica?
I love the supplements. This is one of those that, like you said, it is completely stacked. It is very much in keeping with Criterion's ethos of film school in a box. It offers so much background and insight and context in a way that, even though Criterion has made some fantastic releases, very few of them, I feel like, are this in-depth, in, especially when you're talking about what is essentially a first feature. It's a lot of resources and time and care that went into a package, so it obviously indicates how important that they think it is. And I love it top to bottom. That feature that you mentioned with the Austin Film Society flyers is just my favorite because it has that real punk rock feeling, photoshopped zine. You know, we're going to just do this and stick these flyers up on telephone poles everywhere. It feels so guerrilla to me that I just love it. That's my favorite feature, hands down.
And my favorite part is actually the supplemental book that comes inside, and my favorite part within the book is Richard Linklater's notes essentially sort of his marching orders manifesto for what you should be thinking of when you are in this film and how we are shooting this and how this came to be. That's my absolute favorite part.
As a matter of fact, I grabbed the book thinking the very same thing. It's so refreshing to pick up a Criterion disc. And of course, I love just about every Criterion disc. But we don't get booklets like this anymore, or we seldom do.
Rarely,
and this one is, of course, I didn't read the whole thing beforehand, but it's chock full of detail and little tidbits and little, again, curiosities, fun stuff. And it really does supplement the film. As far as the disc supplements, aside from the commentaries, we've already talked about how Linklater does give a really insightful and interesting commentary. But I liked the cast reunion thing. I thought that was a lot of fun. And actually, yeah, I thought there was Fassbender in the film, but it was on that somebody's shirt in the in that reunion. And just seeing them together, and that was before I realized that these people were all in bands and the all the connections. And also seeing the kids. Remember the kids that stole the sodas and resold them. Seeing them grown up, that was great. So yeah, I felt like this release and the just the volume of supplements really was a celebration of the film and of Austin by extension. So yeah, I think it's even though I don't I gave it an 8, I'd say the Criterion itself is like a 10+. It's really the best you can get.
Yeah, I wholeheartedly agree. Actually, now that you mentioned that, the Les Amis trailer is also something that I really enjoyed, even though it was somewhat sad to see that that's now gone. It made me think of my favorite Austin joke that I was going to tell you guys. The how many Austinites does it take to change a light bulb?
How many?
It takes 3. 1 to change it, and 2 to stand around talking about how much cooler the old light bulb was.
That's good.
Nice.
And that, again, that is every day here.
Yeah. Well, we just did some of it, didn't we?
We did it. We did it ourselves. So.
Yeah, I think we're doing it right now. 1991 was a little cooler.
Yeah.
Although I think 2016 Austin seems pretty cool, too.
Yeah, it's a pretty fun place.
Yeah. I liked it. I'm with you. I think I liked the trailer, like you said. I mean, it was interesting to see the difference there from with Viva Les Amis trailer. I also did like, I'm not sure how much I liked the film, but watching It's Impossible to Learn to Plow by Reading Books, there's so little dialogue, I found myself going in and out of the audio into the commentary. So I'd flip it on and hear Linklater. I'd flip it off to watch some of the movie, and that was a really fun experience. I've never done that before, and he really gives a ton of background. He talks about how someone I thought of, especially with that film, was Chantal Ackerman as a influence, which you can certainly see that. I also thought of, and he said this too, Stranger Than Paradise, the Jim Jarmusch film, very similar. People just kind of hanging around and existing. So yeah, wasn't big on the film, but loved the commentary.
I wish I had thought of that watching the. Yeah, I didn't love the film either. It definitely was amateurish and more experimental than Slacker, I'd say. Tough to get engaged with it, but yeah. I thought it was. It was neat. And anytime there's, we didn't like the Cronenberg early films either, but it's still neat to have them on the disc. And again, a lot of stuff on the disc.
I think I might have liked that film a little bit better than each of you guys, because I'm a big devotee of slow cinema. I really enjoy guys like Ben Rivers, Lav Diaz, that sort of thing. And in addition to the Ackerman, I also saw little bits of Bresson in it, it felt like, and maybe even a little bit of Wim Wenders with the travelogue stuff. I think there's a lot in it that fans of the more sedate Criterion titles might be able to really get into. And again, I was so impressed with how assured it was and how accomplished it was for a kid who had basically just taught himself to use a 16mm camera. I think I did like it better, a little bit better than you guys did.
Yeah, I probably didn't have the chance just because we had to pack all these this huge disc into a week. But I also like slow cinema, as we've talked about a few slow films on this cast. Mm-hmm. But yeah, maybe that's another one to revisit next time I pull this disc out. And
sure.
Although it does, even though it blends into Slacker, it does seem to be, I guess, tonally different and stylistically and I guess pacing wise, very different.
Yeah.
So Aaron, I think we got your Criterion rating of a 10 plus. I would like to hear what Cole and Erica think. I mean, if you're going to rate this thing, scale of 1 to 10.
I would say the same. I give it a heartily endorsed 10 for sure.
Agreed.
Nice. All right, I'm gonna knock it down a notch, only the Blu-ray edition, because I'm giving it a 9 because it's missing some of the DVD extras. So I don't know if it was cost or, you know, they really felt like they'd need to put out a 2-disc Blu-ray. That would have been great, you know, to include those extras. So just going a 9, Criterion rating, because it makes me want to, you know, buy the other one at some point. But and is this canon worthy? What do you think, Aaron? Are we going to canonize this film in the Criterion canon?
No, I would vote no. I think it's very important, but I think other Linklaters, I would vote that, but I
agreed.
Usually my benchmark is a rating of 9 for the actual film, and I'd say for rating this one an 8, it gets closer than another 8 rating film, because I think it's more of an important film, but no, not quite.
Yeah, I'm with you. I mean, Boyhood comes out. That is, if it's a stacked release, that's going to go in. I'd put, if they ever put the, you know, Before Trilogy and maybe Dazed and Confused, but, you know, Linklater will get there at some point. So we will see.
We've reserved a spot on the shelf for him.
Absolutely.
What about you, Cole and Erica? Would you canonize?
I absolutely would in this case. I know I only rated it an 8 as a filmmaking achievement, but I think for me, the space that it occupies as kind of bringing the American underground right then to a head. Like I said, when I was a kid in Southwest Oklahoma, figuring out Spike Lee, Jim Jarmusch, and all these other guys that I was hearing whispers on the wind about, it was Slacker that really crystallized that for me. And in the same way, possibly Shadows or Faces might have done for the generation before me, I feel like this is kind of a watershed moment for American indies, and I think I would canonize it just on that alone.
Sure. I agree with Cole and disagree with you gentlemen. Sorry. I definitely would canonize it, and for the exact same reasons that Cole just mentioned, it changed the world for some of us. And it would be one thing if the film itself didn't stand the test of time, wasn't particularly that great, wasn't that well made, but it still hits those, ticks those boxes, and it's the thing by which so many other films that came after it were judged, and it is the one that we're still talking about. So I absolutely would put it in the canon.
Well, we're tied. This is a first. Well, it's actually the first time we've had four people. So how do we break this tie, Mark?
We flip a coin, or we—I don't know—whoever gets the highest bid on the next Madonna Pap smear decides whether it's.
Since we're in election year, we could caucus, and I'll come over to Cole and Erica's side, I'll cast the deciding vote. Sorry, Mark.
Cool.
I agree. If it is important for independent cinema, and 1991 was a hotbed of independent cinema, you know, and I think that has led to, it's definitely evolved in the 20 some odd years since then, but I think there's still a space for it and for Linklater.
Nice.
All right, going in the canon. Sorry, Mark.
Canonized.
I beat you up.
Hey, that's okay. I mean, I can come over on the caucus. So yeah, fair enough. So that is Slacker from Richard Linklater, and we wanted to thank everyone for listening. And Cole and Erica, we loved having you on here to discuss this with us. We've been wanting to do this for a while, and folks should definitely check out your podcast, The Magic Lantern. Love listening to it. I know it's magiclanternpodcast.com. Where else can folks find you?
You can find us on Facebook. Just search for Magic Lantern Podcast. Follow us on Twitter at lantern_cast. Check out the website. You can get our Gmail on there as well, and we would love to hear from everybody.
Definitely give them a listen. As you can hear, they have great voices and great interaction and really insightful discussion. So loved having you on, and hope to have you again.
And they are husband and wife, and they do talk to each other, and they have great rapport with each other, too. And I think we stole some of that rapport away from them today. Sorry. Sorry, you too. So it is a very fun listen. And, of course, we'll put all the links in the show notes, so you can just a click away.
Cool. folks can find Criterion Close-Up, of course, on Twitter at CriterionCU, on CriterionCloseUp.com on the web, and Facebook/CriterionCloseUp. Aaron, folks can find you on Twitter.
Yes, AWest505, and I have a new one. You can find me on Tumblr at CriterionBlues.tumblr.com. I've just started, actually, Kristen, the episode that's coming out this week, she inspired me to join that party. So
nice. Good party. And you can find me, Mark Herney, at M-H-U-R-N-E on Twitter, at Mark Herney, and Letterboxd. And next week, we have a Criterion Close-Up episode. We're going to be talking about this thing that we are doing right now, podcasting. So have a special guest for that, a couple folks that have been doing it for quite some time. So we'll look forward to that. Thank you, everyone, for joining us on Criterion Close-Up. And we're going to play the ending song to the film, the last scene in Slacker, to lead us out.